Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web, and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernard.
We are coming to you live on geeksofdoom.com. And just a programming note before we begin. We had a mix-up where we uploaded last week's episode to the wrong account.
Oh, no.
So subscribers to the Roundup on iTunes got to listen to our terrific interview with top Reddit users. And the Drill Down iTunes subscribers got bupkis.
Maybe wow, because of the names of your podcast, Andy.
That's your new ad strategy. Get it out there.
if you downloaded the show directly from Geeks of Doom, you were fine. And it's just the iTunes subscribers, and we're going to correct that. And you'll get last week's episode in your iTunes feed probably just before this week's episode posts. And I highly recommend you go back and listen to it if you haven't. It's a fascinating look into an incredibly popular online community, and it's totally worth checking out. It's actually one of my favorite episodes so far of our show. So
because we're not all on it, I hear you.
No, we really. By the way, we really did miss you, Devendra. I wish that you were on. But
I'm sad that I was out in Barcelona. It's okay.
You can't just have one Guyanese person on the TV on the show.
Sad that I wasn't on it. It would have been nice to have like top Reddit users and then bottom Reddit users.
So how do you keep your karma so low? Tell me your secrets.
Actually, I got it on
49.
I'm a bottom Reddit user, and I just was like, I got to step back from this because these guys are on a level that I felt like I was listening to Ender's Game. Like, when they're on the forums and they're like changing the world via what they're blogging. Yeah. And I felt like that's what I was listening to. Like, I was listening to like Demonstenes and everybody else just kind of.
It was really fascinating. It was like listening to this weird, super genius hive mind. But it's totally worth checking out. But this week on the show, we're going to explore Microsoft Windows 8 consumer preview and, of course, Apple's latest update in their popular iPad tablet line, the new iPad. And, of course,
the iPad.
Just iPad.
We'll get into that.
And of course, this week's latest tech headlines. But first, occasionally on the show, we like to do a segment called What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, games, and tech that has obsessed us in the past week. And I have a couple of items that I've been toying around with this week. As you know, I am a hardcore gamer. Not a hardcore gamer, but I have been a pretty regular gamer pretty much all my life. I used to be a hardcore gamer, but now I always keep my fingers in it. And this week I played with a couple of different new kind of casual apps. One is not new. It's Minecraft, which we've talked about before in the show, but this week they had a update, kind of a major update, a 1.2 release, and the big thing about that is they've got cats in the world, and it doesn't sound like a huge difference, but if you love cats, I mean, it actually had me stuck in the world for a long time.
Are you a cat lover?
I am a cat lover. But they had cats, ocelots, which are kind of like grown up wild cats.
SARS.
SARS. What?
They had there's a new jungle world, like a new jungle biome. So like vines covering everything, and it's basically a new like environment. Iron golems that you can create, which will fight mobs for you. A new artificial intelligence for mobs, which are the bad guys in Minecraft. And now mobs can actually open doors in your houses, in your domiciles, which is a little scary because, and I didn't even know about this until I found out the hard way when a zombie knocked on and opened my door, and all of a sudden I had this bad guy in my house when I'm used to
terrifying.
Being
dude, that is terrifying. I should know. Oh,
You know, that's one thing that people don't talk about as much anymore because the sort of like building part of Minecraft has taken over. Yeah. But like one thing that really drew me into Minecraft when I first got into it is it was one of the scariest games I had ever played. Like, and in an awesome, like, very visceral, terrifying way. Like, you sort of start off and you're just like, oh, this is nice. And then, like, just there's something just unbelievably terrifying about that game. And I'm really glad that even, like, was it now 2 years almost since it came out, like, that they can still get that sort of visceral terror out of playing it. Because there's very few other games that really do that.
And it's terror that affects you by, I mean, it's not detailed gore, it's these big blocky characters, but there's something about that impersonality of those characters that I think enhances the fear, the fear factor there. But I feel like this with this update, they've really kind of refreshed the game itself. It has a whole kind of new feel to it. So give it a chance. All you got to do is load up Minecraft, and it'll automatically update from there. Since it's a jar, you know, what do you call it? It's
Java executable.
Java, yeah. And the other thing I played with was a new game called Mario, and it's basically Super Mario Brothers, where Mario has a portal gun. So they've added like portal mechanics into the classic Super Mario Brothers game, and you can play all of the classic Super Mario Brothers levels, except with being able to put portals anywhere, and you can use this to avoid enemies or send enemies, you know, send Goombas off into places where you're not, so they don't affect you. Or reach into places where you haven't been able to reach before. And there's also a whole other map pack that is essentially a recreation of the Portal, original Portal game, but on in a 16-bit fashion. So done in kind of a Mario world. And this was a lot of fun.
I thought it worked a lot better with a sort of sideways one. I played a little bit. I was playing with a trackpad, so it didn't really get the right effect. It's definitely not designed to be played with a trackpad. it was pretty fun, though, to hang around, you know, to find cool ways to kill the Goombas. But I ended up dying more often because of losing time. But so it was an awesome game.
Yeah. It's a really innovative idea. I'm really glad that they did this. And so I'm totally looking forward to. You can also do your own custom levels too. I'm looking forward to some custom levels to see what other people have done. Dwayne, how about you? What have you been playing with this week?
I've been playing with something that, again, isn't like Minecraft isn't too new, but I just started getting into it. I've been kind of Amazoning my life away, and by that I mean a lot of people like direct deposit their life away or auto pay their life away. I kind of redid all that stuff a few weeks ago. I got a new, very points-driven Amex card that I turned everything onto. But I started Amazoning my life away with the food subscriptions on Amazon Prime. So I'm basically de facto starting a food co-op in my job. And how this works is that a couple of my work friends or whatever, we're into like eating oatmeal because it's wintertime or whatever, and we started with oatmeal. You go and you get the oatmeal. You have it. You have like some craisins, maybe some nuts, some brown sugar, whatever. And it all comes at regular intervals from Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the office and it's just there and it's good and we're doing it. And then they pay me back whatever for whatever they use. And it's just kind of cool. And I'm thinking, as much as I like going like my local farmer's markety kind of shop thing, Sunflower out here in Boulder, it's kind of nice to have the food come to me. And on some level it's greener because then it's not getting shipped to a store and then I'm driving to the store or whatever. So I've begun like kind of trying to make flows about my like life and what it is that I need when I need it. I've been kind of graphing it all out, like figuring out like what
it's,
it is
it's
I
great
eat,
for that.
How much
I've been
I
using
eat.
That for razor blades actually, and it's great because like every couple of months, you know, you kind of forget you got to buy a new pack or something.
Right,
now,
right.
Automated shipments; those things are great.
I mean, it's like you rely so much on the grid at that point.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, I'm not saying that I'm some sort of weird survivalist, whatever. But I am in Colorado, and I do have a phobia of zombies. So,
because that's where the zombie apocalypse will happen first.
Well, have you read World War Z? This is the place to be. Like, we're in good shape. So, that and the fact that you can walk around town with a gun on your hip, no problem, just in case. So, it's just, like, funny that I found myself, like, leaning on Amazon to provide this. Especially because Amazon and Colorado are having a big fight over taxing right now. And it's like, you know, if they figure it all shit out, I could end up having to pay, like, a chunk of taxes later on. But in the end, it's cool. It's awesome. And my coworkers love the idea that, like, we're getting what we need delivered to the office and taking care of business.
Devinder, how about yourself? You just mentioned the razor blade thing. You tweeted out this week a little something about a razor blade.
Oh, yeah, there's this new company called Dollar Shave Club, which I think is just really cool. Basically, it's like
it's hilarious.
It's hilarious and it's so useful that I think everybody should just sign up for it, because, like, starting at $1 a month, you can get, like, monthly shipments of razors to your home, and, like, decent razors that you could use. There's like a $6 one, I think, and a $9 one that has six blades and all sorts of cool lubricants and stuff. That's probably the one I'm going to end up getting. But I spend around $18 a month or so for a pack of Gillette, one of their
vibrating
ones. It's crazy.
And the weird thing about it is that, like, when they have the little Kickstarter video, one thing that they do pull out, and I think this is really relevant to the show, is the over-engineering of the razor. The actual, like, stick that holds the blade, the fact that they have batteries now and they're, like, trying to vibrate, and they, like, the weird massaging.
I have a vibrating razor, you know. I thought, you know, maybe it makes a difference. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. As much as that happens, like, I mean, and they make a joke that, you know, like, now they've got, like, five blades when his grandfather used one or whatever. I get that the technology has moved forward. But I remember the first time I saw the whole thing with the battery-powered, like, Gillette whatever, and I thought, wow. They're at a point where economically they need to get more money because, like, the capitalism says they need to grow. This is how they're planning on doing it, and it seems completely absurd. Now, that comes from a guy who doesn't shave. Like, I don't need to shave.
You don't need to shave.
At the most, I grow a goatee. I have a natural goatee. It takes about 7 or 8 weeks to grow in, but my cheeks don't need shaving. And my chest is as bare as the day I was born, so I'm not really a very hairy guy.
Not really the target audience.
But yeah, this looks cool, and I'm probably going to sign up for it. Dollar Shave Club is the name.
Kickstarter.
I don't even think it's a Kickstarter company. I think it's legit. Like, they've gotten $1 million.
Oh, they have some big-time investors behind them.
Yeah, this is Jason Horowitz, Shasta Ventures. These are real folks. So it's cool. You know, I think it's a really good upgrade. I'm also playing with Mass Effect 3, which came out literally yesterday, and is awesome. I love this game. I was telling Dwayne about it. What's really interesting about Mass Effect 3 is that they're basically progressing your narrative from the first game, which came out, I think, like 2005, 2006?
2007. It came out a while ago. It came out in 2007.
I
just bought the first game, and it says it's published in 2007.
Okay. And then the Mass Effect 2 came out, I believe, last year or the year before. I think it was
2010.
And yeah, it was. I think it was. Mass Effect 2 carried over some of your, you know, you could carry over your characters and some of your decisions from the first game. And Mass Effect 3 is bringing everything you've done, you know, in those first two games, and just having them make real impacts on how the game works. I think that's really cool. It's really cool to, like, have one character that you've been with for years, basically, and to, like, finish this narrative with them. So it's a great game so far. You know, I've loved the series. If you haven't played it, you could probably just start with Mass Effect 2. PlayStation 3 owners have no choice. They can only start with Mass Effect 2.
Can I ask you, how does that work? How do you carry over?
They get the game save. So you have your game save, like, sitting there in, you know, your Xbox's hard drive, and it just finds the old one, and it brings over the relevant information.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's shocking to me that it still works.
So if you got, like, the little red light of death on your old Xbox, it's kind of over for you.
Well, and no, because you don't lose your hard drive when that happens. You just move your hard drive over to a new Xbox. If you lose your data, then it is over, which is why even for game saves, I recommend people back up stuff. Although now everybody who has Xbox Live, I believe, can just save a couple game saves to the cloud, too. We all have, like...
Why don't you do that defaultly? How big is the game save?
Well, I feel like the game save's big. Be big, and it's not you know, not everybody has internet. It's not always fast. So it's easier to just, like, if you want to copy something to the cloud for safekeeping, you could do that as well with the new Xbox update. So there's that. I've also been catching up on Spartacus Vengeance, which is the Spartacus show is amazing. And nobody, like, not enough people are watching it. I don't think
it's confusing, though, because the show.
It's not that.
Well, it's confusing because it has three names. It's Spartacus, like, it was Spartacus, like, and then it was Spartacus something else. And now it's called Spartacus Vengeance.
It's not that confusing, though, because it's like any subtitle. It's Spartacus. That's the first name. The first series was Spartacus Blood and Sand. They had, like, this prequel series as the main actor was he was dealing with cancer. And he ended up passing away as well. Shortly before this season started shooting. So they replaced him in Spartacus Vengeance. It's like a really interesting series that just sort of... there's a lot of action. There's a lot of blood and sex and everything. But it's also like a great drama. Really tightly
Lucy
written.
Lawless, topless.
Lucy Lawless, topless, although not looking, as much this season.
Looking wonderful. I gotta say, as a guy who was like 16 when this movie came out, looking at Lucy Lawless topless,
all your fantasies come true.
Yeah, it was pretty huge. Like Xena with her boobies out. Like I was like, whoa. Yeah.
Well, this show has more going for it than that, but it is really about like the pursuit of power in ancient Rome, with some great action, just like a great look too. Like they tried to take the 300 look, but they're building like entire digital sets too. It's a really great show. It's a really compelling show. I think it's one of the best dramas on TV, but not enough people are watching it. So if you do get a chance, you know, check it out. I think it's still on Netflix. It's, you know, it's not really, it only has like...
Is it like Showtime or Stars?
It's
one of those
two. It's Stars. So that's going to be going away from Netflix soon. But it's not a very long series, so you can catch up pretty quickly.
And that's kind of what's great about it, Game of Thrones, and a couple other period-focused series that have come out in the last like 2 or 3 years. At 13 episodes or 12 episodes or 10 episodes, you don't have the burden of sort of the network TV 20-episode rush to like figure it all out. You know, like it gets it done. Mm-hmm. The episodes are like a little longer, maybe 10 minutes longer than when you find on network. So like 52 minutes instead of 43 minutes, that kind of thing. And you really like get in there and you get out within like a month if you've been watching it just every other day or whatever, you know? Like it's really something. So I gotta say, I like Spartacus. I saw only the first season. I was sorry that
it's worth keeping up.
Yeah, it's a good show though.
All right, so let's get into some of our headlines. Now, Devendra, you were out last week because you were at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. Is that correct?
I was. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was my first time there and my first time in Barcelona, first time at the conference. And, you know, I've been to a lot of tech conferences, and I think that one is one of my favorites just because Barcelona is kind of amazing and the overall vibe there is pretty chill and also much more international than things like CES and other events that, you know, are mainly U.S. focused.
Tell us about what were the highlights. Well, one thing that we were going to talk about last week, but we figured we'd save for this week because I know you must have seen it firsthand, was the 41 megapixel 808 PureView from Nokia.
Yes. And so Nokia announced, you know, this phone that has a crazy 41 megapixel camera. I don't think too many people were expecting it. There were reports that, you know, Nokia had some crazy camera thing going out there. Nobody really believed it. But this thing seems legitimate. So what they did is they basically created this new camera technology that, that they could fit a really great lens on this camera. But to get over the fact that you have a giant 41 megapixel file, they also have a technology that kind of just downscales them into sort of like 5 megapixel sized images, but retains much of the quality. So you can still share them with your friends and put them on Facebook and something. But the images still look great. They actually
can you
look
do raw.
I don't know what if it's going to do raw. There is a way for you to shoot fully uncompressed, I think, or at least shoot at full resolution.
That's good enough.
And it's like 38 megapixels. And when you do that, like, you can zoom in like crazy. Nokia put up a few sample shots on their Flickr account. You can go take a look for yourself. It looks amazing what this little phone can do. The only problem is the phone itself is running Symbian Belle, which is their kind of newer Symbian OS.
Mm-hmm.
It's useless, is the thing. Like, you won't want to own...
It's the new OS. It's useless.
Well, I heard...
want to own that phone. That's the only problem.
I heard that it wasn't coming to the U.S. anyway, right?
I mean, just like the N9 last year, which was sort of like an experimental phone for them as well. Yeah, this one is not slated to come to the U.S. Eager people can, import it or whatever. The real key is this technology that next year or 2 years from now they can put into their new Windows phones. It's fascinating what they've been able to do. Well, they've been working on this phone for like 5 or 6 years, so long before the Windows phone deal. And they kind of just wanted to get this thing out there, I guess, and to prove that they have this technology. The thing is, like, it's not a very, it's not a phone that too many people are going to want, but it's, as a technology, kind of stole the show because it's just so amazing. 41 megapixels, this is better than any of your point and shoots.
How does it contend with the megapixel myth? Like, remember the megahertz myth, and you had the Athlon because the Athlon was maybe lower clocked, but like it hit the Intel things.
Yeah.
Same thing with megapixel. Like, it's megapixels plus the lens plus the processor.
There's definitely that myth, but the thing is, it's Nokia. And this is a company known for always building great cameras in their phones. So they know, the whole deal. Like, they know about the image sensor, getting that right. They know about the lenses and getting good quality glass and everything. So it seems like they just kind of brought together everything they knew so far to create this image sensor. And, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually looking at those Flickr photos that you...
Yeah, just zoom in. Like, zoom in as much as you can. Like, open it in Photoshop or something. Mm-hmm. You can get some crazy detail in those things.
Yeah. What else did you see at the Mobile World Conference that really, that you were...
Yeah. Well, there were a couple product announcements. The thing is, this happened a month after CES. So it almost feels like some companies just saved some of their weaker announcements for this. So Samsung showed off like the Galaxy Tab or the Galaxy Note 10-inch, which is like a new 10-inch tablet with the Galaxy Note stylus. I like the stylus. It's kind of cool. So this may be a better thing than their plain 10-inch tablets. And HTC showed off their new One series of Android phones as well. One interesting thing I noticed, I expected a lot of quad-core phones at Mobile World Congress. NVIDIA was talking about their Tegra 3 chipset and everything. Apparently, Tegra 3 does not work with LTE. And that's a really interesting
thing. What? Product. Why?
It doesn't. So apparently, I don't think they can like either fit the chipsets in to these super thin phones or something. So the HTC One, which is everywhere else in the world going to be like a quad core Tegra powerhouse, when it comes to the US, it's only going to be a dual core phone because the US prefers to have LTE. And this is a problem every single phone is going to face in the US that's been trying to use Tegra 3. So
I mean, on some level, what are the other... Okay, so like, what are... I feel like... I get that the U.S. wants LTE. The speed of your network is really important.
Yeah.
Is it just that the speed of the network in other cultures and, Europe?
Well, nobody
else
has LTE. Like, nobody has rapidly deployed LTE like we do. So we have, the greatest LTE deployment so far.
We're ahead for the first time ever?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying?
I think so. And so there's that. And also, I think in America, the idea of LTE 4G is just more compelling to people than a quad-core CPU because you don't know what exactly you could do with a quad-core CPU, right?
And
you
just got dual-core. We got dual-core like last year.
It was like last year. So, it's a weird situation we're in. Maybe by the end of this year, NVIDIA says that the Tegra 3 and some of the other LTE chipsets may be able to play better together. But it's really interesting that like the big thing that everybody was waiting for at Mobile World Congress was kind of... there was a lot of water thrown on it.
Hmm. Yeah, the images of that phone are astounding. Yeah.
Like, the peer review is cool. The conference itself is really cool, and I enjoyed talking with a lot of people. I did this little mini conference too, called Bob Bubble Over Barcelona, which is kind of cool. We just talked about like bubbly technologies and what things are overrated and whatnot. So that was fun. I just really enjoyed it. I can't wait to go back next year. Unlike CES, which I dread every freaking year.
Well, maybe it's the new CES, or maybe it's only mobile, but
it is. It's the biggest mobile conference.
That's what's so good about it. It's focused, and it's like you need focus. Like I get CES, but like if you're gonna have an electronics show, and I get that the world is moving toward mobile. I mean, there are more iPhones bought every day than there are babies born on the planet. But if you get, it's true.
I'm not sure that's the statistic.
No, I could send you that statistic. I had to research it heavily.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually.
Yeah, it's like 300. It's a number in the 300,000s. It's kind of ridiculous.
Every newborn gets an iPhone.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that the focus is like something that I think would actually help in terms of all that information. Like, if you're going to drop me a ton of information every day as I walk around and see all your wares, if it's in mobile, I get to understand the mobile universe, where it's going. I get to be able to extrapolate trends and everything. But when it's CES, it's kind of like a it's like a flea market of everything.
Well, CES isn't really a show meant for consumers is the other problem, right? It's not really a show for the press. It's more for the people who buy and sell, you know, electronics for retail chains and whatnot, right, and who are trying to make business deals. So it's a really confused conference. Mobile World Congress, on the other hand, I think is, you know, it knows what it wants to do, and which is nice. And also, another great thing that happened, Eric Schmidt had a really great keynote. I wrote about AdventureBeat. We also put a video up there, too. It's on YouTube. Just Google Eric Schmidt, Mobile World Congress keynote. Really cool stuff.
Like, he
really
put his foot in his mouth?
No. He's really passionate. He's talking about futurist ideas and technologies. You guys should all watch it, because everybody listening to this show would get something out of it.
All right. Let's move on. Speaking of mobile issues, customers using AT&T's 3G network will see their data speeds be cut after reaching 3 gigabytes. Users on the carrier's 4G LTE network will see their speeds throttled after 5 gigabytes. These changes are a reaction to the backlash against the company after speeds were greatly diminished after 2 gigabytes or so of use.
Changes.
Yeah. They said that they're going to reduce the speeds of the top 5% of users in a given area, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is all about, like, okay, unlimited, what does it mean? It means that you can get as much data as you want without getting overcharged.
Unlimited means nothing anymore.
That's what it means technically. Like, when I looked at it from a legal standpoint, like, what you can say is that you'll always get data. You will never
get
charged
some
using
data.
More data.
Yeah.
But we're not going to give you the highest tier, the highest throughput rate.
Yeah.
At any given time, once you hit this area right here, this number of megabytes downloaded, you know, 5,000 megabytes for LTE or whatever, we're going to limit your throughput, and you still have it. It's unlimited in terms of the amount of data you can get, but for the fact that the throughput rate will lower, which is something that someone can actually contest. I mean, we heard earlier last month in February. Someone got $850 for suing AT&T for getting throttled. So AT&T is probably, their PR guys were like, okay, like, we got to figure this out, because we know what happened when the iPhone first showed up. We didn't get it. We couldn't do the data. We couldn't get it out to people enough. Now that we've built our network and it's relatively reliable, we have to protect it, and that's how we're protecting it. Mm-hmm. I think there's still room for people to get together and say, look, unlimited means you will not limit me after a certain point in terms of speed. Unlimited, like, what does unlimited mean? I think the unlimited plans are going to go away, just like how we've seen.
Well,
with
they've already gone away. Yeah. Let's be clear here. AT&T's unlimited plans have already gone away.
Yeah.
These rules are for the people who still have legacy.
The legacy, exactly. Those are all going to go away once we hit 4G.
Who knows? Although right now, like, the idea of having, I guess by next year or so, like when the iPhone with LTE comes out, those grandfathered accounts, it sounds like you'd be able to get technically a grandfathered LTE account, but who knows? Who knows what's going to end up happening?
Because remember when the 2G iPhone account was around, the minute the 3G iPhone account came around, people who upgraded were told, we have a 3G account. This is what you have to pay. You have to pay $30 and then like $40, so it's going to cost you more money. And that's how it's been ever since then. I think when the 4G accounts come out, if I were AT&T and I were their legal staff and I were their business guys, I would say 4G is not 3G, therefore I've got to do whatever. Now, that said, we'll talk about iOS 5.1 later, but that's being called 4G and I don't see my plan changing at all, so we'll see what happens.
All right, moving on here. In a giant strategic step, Zynga has launched a new Zynga.com destination website where users can play its social games without going directly through Facebook. The move has big implications for the entire social game industry, and it has been long awaited by observers who felt that Zynga was overly dependent on Facebook. Facebook gets 12% of its revenue from Zynga, and Zynga gets more than 90% of its revenue from Facebook. Now those numbers are about to change. Zynga is also announcing the Zynga platform for publishing games built by external publishers and developers. Facebook is certain to take notice. If Zynga's move is successful, it could actually undermine Facebook's upcoming IPO, but Zynga took pains to note that it is not getting a divorce from Facebook.
This is wonderful, guys. I mean, like, the
idea
that
they're just
having
a separation, you know.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. The idea that Zynga can – I mean, I'm sure they'll use Facebook Connect on the Zynga side if they want to. But the idea that Zynga can take – get out of, like, the teat of Facebook and, like, you know, kind of be weaned and become its own full-fledged thing is only good for everybody. And then the fact that they wanna take the app model and say, hey, Chris, you want to code a game and put it on Zynga? You're right there, you know. Make it free, make it charge, whatever. Like, that model is a good model. Like, the idea that, like, this is – Facebook is actually, like, kind of helping to create – and I mean, this is kind of like – you know, I don't want to sound political, but they're creating jobs. They're creating a space where people can, like, launch on Facebook and then move away. And they'll still have the relationship with Facebook, but then there's a destination that's independent too, you know? Like, you got to grow up sometime. And I think Zynga, after last year, where Zynga's profits, like, fell and everything like that, this is a good independent-making move.
I just hope that I don't start getting, like, emails being like, you know, so-and-so signed up for Castle Cleaning Roomville. Like, you're in their contacts. You want to play? Like, I've already gotten rid of that on Facebook. It just, I mean, it's a smart move for them. That's what they absolutely need to do. Like, yeah, they got launched on Facebook. It was clear they were way too close. They're a publicly traded company. As long as Facebook and Zynga are separate entities, they need to at least have the appearance of being. I'd be very curious how much of Zynga's revenue is coming from their mobile / independent thing like this versus obviously in 6 months from now, like not immediately, you know, versus, you know, this other stuff. But
we've discussed this on the show before about how the longevity of Zynga's social games like this in general, and like my wife wondered, well, how long are people going to really want to continue to play Farmville or Cityville or whatever, Castleville? And I thought she initially had a point, but then I thought about like PopCap, and that PopCap's been going on for a long time, essentially using the same business model. And people haven't stopped playing Peggle or Bejeweled.
It seems like we're innately either drawn to these things or something. Do you guys remember Cow Clicker?
No.
That was the game. Okay, so Cow Clicker was the game that a guy made to make fun of Facebook games, right? Like, it's a game where you get a cow, and you click on it, and it moves. And people got really into it. It got really crazy. And then when he killed the game, like, people got sad, and, like, it was this whole thing. There's actually, I think there's a This American Life episode about Cow Clicker. It's amazing, it's ridiculous, and it shows that, you know, social gaming is here to stay. It just makes me really, really, really sad. That's pretty much it.
Okay, let's move on here. Google is unifying its digital entertainment offerings in a single cloud-based destination called Google Play. Android Market, Google Music, and the Google eBook Store will become part of this new online emporium. Your books, videos, music, apps will also be upgraded to Google Play Movies, Google Play Books, and Google Play Music apps. The music, movies, books, and apps you've purchased will continue to be available through Google Play. Simply log in with your Google account, like always. I tried this out, and I liked it. I liked the consolidation of all of these into one kind of umbrella destination.
Google is definitely a consolidating company now. It seems to be their term for this year.
Yeah,
it's got to, like, I feel like Google Music didn't take off, and. No. I mean, they still have whatever there, but this is what I think if Apple were to do this, people would say, man, you know, like, this is how it should be. And I think Google bit the bullet first. Like, right now there's the App Store and then there's like iTunes, and you can buy an app on iTunes, but iTunes is really focused toward like entertainment content and not apps, which actually are entertainment content. And you can do this from the web, which all of us can use quickly and cleanly. Unlike the sort of like weird like floating trash cloud that iTunes has become on my computer.
That's a good way to describe it.
So I'm like, I haven't been the biggest fan of Google over the last few months because of some of the decisions they've been making, but this is a wonderful, wonderful piece of kit for them.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Anybody else give this a try? Check it out. They're also doing a thing where, like, for the next week, every day they've got like a movie,
25-cent albums and movies and shit. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, just to get everybody enticed on it. So I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, it seems more like a branding change than anything. Like, I understand the need to consolidate everything, but replacing Android Market for a lot of people just seems like a weird, confusing thing. Like, I'm looking on some of my Android phones now on Google TV. All of a sudden, the place I normally went to get my stuff is now something else, and nothing told me this. Like, I
never
got
an alert. Interstitials. They've got to put interstitials. They've got to put
it's really confusing.
And they've got to do that. But I think that the idea of Google Play is much smarter than having a separate music and an app location and a movie location. The movie prices aren't comparable with iTunes, except that they're maybe not as much. You only rent right now, I feel like. I was looking around. I couldn't really buy anything. But no, I could buy one. You can choose. Once you buy, you can choose to stream it from the web or you can download it. But either way, I mean, it's just like the Google focuses on the web. And this is one of those places where I look at the docs and stuff, especially like the spreadsheet doc that you can do on Google. It's not as powerful as the native app. But this is perfect for the web. And Amazon's pioneered it, but Google's made it sensible. Because when I go on Amazon and look for content, all I get is confused and I walk away. So it's great.
It also makes sense for, like, you know, Google Music and some of the other ways you can purchase stuff. It's sort of weird before, like, oh, you want to buy something on Google Music? Oh, well, go to market.android.com. And you're like, what?
What?
Like, why am I going there? Yeah. So,
well, I mean, Apple, why are you going to iTunes to pick up an app? Like, it's. You know.
I want to draw attention to this in connection with Google's – something I saw in a comment on Google's purchase of ITA recently. So ITA is the company that builds – sort of powers all of the flight search stuff out there. And obviously it's something that fits into Google's motto of organizing the world's information. They purchased it recently and it was – I think recently actually approved to go through. And there was an article I was reading that was commenting that Google really wants to get people's credit card information. Like, there is a fight happening right now for who is going to be the next payment platform. Because while PayPal sort of was the original one and Amazon sort of is somewhat of a follow-up one, those are both very, very, very web-based and no one is doing anything sort of in terms of mobile. And so you have Square and you have – I guess Stripe sort of, and Google and definitely Apple, you know, all sort of vying to be the next payment platform. And Google is definitely making a move for that. I think Google is basically trying to do anything and everything they can to get your credit card on store with them so that then once they have your credit card, then, oh, you know, this particular store holds, you know, Google Wallet. Well,
right.
You know, I can play with that. It's so much easier. Like, I think that it'll be a long time before they have that, but once they can go to stores and be like, hey, you know, we have 100 million people who are on Google Wallet, you should use our stuff, then suddenly they're going to have yet another cash printing machine that has nothing to do with search or analytics, which is sort of going to address a criticism Dwayne has long had about Google, is that they are essentially a one-trick pony. No matter what they do, it always amounts to analyzing your behavior and selling you ads. And
well, that's what they'll do, Chris. That's what they'll do if they have if they're a payment processing company, they will analyze your data and send you ads about more things that based on things that you bought. That'll be in their privacy policy 100%. I mean, I would do it. They should do it. That's what they want to do. Now, we need more diversity in this privacy in this payment situation. I think that Google has some good ideas. The whole NFC push. I think these are good ideas, and I think that, yeah, they want that. They've wanted your credit cards ever since they've launched Google Checkout, which was, what, 2009. We were doing the Symbiotic podcast, and Google Checkout was, like, a thing. You got 10% off when you bought anything from it. So they've been wanting your credit card for a while. They've got a couple. They're doing better than Facebook in this regard, but, you know, they want to do even better. This is the way to do it.
Yeah. Speaking of Google and privacy – Google's new consolidated privacy policy violates European law, according to European Union Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding, citing findings by data protection agencies in EU countries. The France's independent privacy watchdog, the CNIL, I won't even bother to attempt to pronounce what that stands for, they've already concluded the new policy did not meet the requirements of the European Directive on Data Protection And they informed Google that they'll be leading an EU-wide probe into the new policy. Google's defended the policy update, saying that as you use our products, one thing will be clear. It's the same Google experience that you're used to with the same controls. Despite these assurances, the change has been criticized by everyone from members of Congress and state attorneys general to the European Commission and privacy groups. I feel like we're about to see another Microsoft versus the DOJ coming up here.
I don't think so. I think that these guys – first of all, the EU needs to focus on fucking Greece and Italy and get the fuck out of this because they made the mistake of giving those guys 4% loans that are fucking up the entire world economy. So fuck those guys. Secondly, when it comes to Congress and what Google's trying to do, if Google needs to, it will make YouTube.google.com. The fact is all of this shit is Google. And the idea that like the consumer – may not have realized that all this was Google, even though Google was like, hey, look, big press releases, we bought YouTube, we bought this, we bought that. All of this is Google. Now, does Google have the right to take the information being used on its network to entertain people and try to leverage that information for monetization? I think so. Nothing on the internet is free. Nothing at all. Google has done an excellent job, and I think you guys might agree with me, that you've been annoyed for the last 3 or 4 weeks every time you log in saying, hey, our privacy policy is changing. Look at this. Look at that. They have an education campaign. They, like, battered me over the head with their privacy policy and how they changed it and how they're going to do it. Like, they've done everything possible on the web. They've been above board in ways that networks like Akamai and BlueKai can't even think about. In terms of showing the individual how it is that they plan on using the information that they collect in order to do a good job of, you know, sending them, you know, content and advertising that is actually reflective of the individual's needs. And I think that's a good, good thing. I don't want to see ads for tampons when I browse the web because I don't need tampons. I don't buy tampons. You know,
you never know, Dwayne. Not how it is. You never know.
Maybe I'll find a third party use for them, like, I don't know, fixing my clogged whatever. But the bottom line is, you know, like a toilet bowl or something. I don't know. The bottom line is that, like, I'd like to see ads for things that I'm interested in. If I'm going to see ads at all, ads that attract me. I'd like to be enlightened about new products and new things that are based on my preferences, and I'm okay with letting somebody know. Because the whole idea is that privacy isn't about keeping your shit, like, locked down and hidden from everybody in the world. It's about making sure that the person who has your information treats it respectfully and uses it to your advantage in a way that you've said is okay. That's what privacy is. It's not complete confidentiality and sequestering. Mm-hmm. And this is a big evolution that I've gone through, having spent time with, like, Devinger and so on and so forth. Like, privacy is focused not on just saying, no, you can't have my information, but, okay, what are you going to do with it? Let's focus on, like, what I want out of that. That's what Google's trying to do.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's also really important about this is, like, this is going to allow you to go to one place to find your stuff, like, as opposed to every single Google product having a different, like, oh, where's the privacy settings on this particular one?
It's
like one page.
It's a login, too, which is annoying at sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I don't know. I haven't always been a fan of Google's stances on privacy, but in this particular case, I really can't come up with any reason to be enraged at them.
It seems like this is the way things should have been, I guess. So, like, they just they had so many different services, they never took the time to, like, unify them in a way that this is useful.
It
as
just
aside,
bothers me, like,
go ahead.
I think honestly a lot of this is just, like, posturing by various political groups, because honestly, like,
in the EU
groups,
especially,
it's like, oh, listen, we're gonna you know, put cameras everywhere and, like, log everything you do, but we're the government. Google can't do that, like,
exactly.
Even if you explicitly
the government is by its very nature a group of people who are ungoverned, and, you know, that's the problem. Like, Google's saying, hey, look, let me just treat people like human beings, and the government's like, no, you're not us, so you can't do that. No, screw those.
Well, you know, as the aside I was talking about, Dwayne and Chris, did you know that the, like, two most powerful men in Greece right now actually went to Amherst College, our alma mater?
Oh,
so
really?
They're actually, like, directly responsible for just.
Yes!
Oh. Wait, the guy.
School
the guys
the, USA. The guys, USA.
Wait, the guys who are responsible, the guys the EU threw in there to fix that shit.
Well, no. The Greek prime minister and his, like, the main opposition leader both went to our school. So this is what we're known for. Just so you, we're destroying the world.
Hey, we're liberal arts. We don't do numbers, you know.
Well, what's also funny is that our school's motto is, like, be future leaders. It was some, like, something they hammered into people.
They will light up the world. They will
Light
the
up
people.
The world. By bankrupting Europe.
Yes.
Okay, moving on here. Law enforcement agents on two continents swooped in on top of members of the infamous computer hacking group LulzSec this week and acting largely on evidence gathered by the organization's brazen leader, whose sources say have been secretly working with the government for months. Oops. They arrested three and charged two more with conspiracy.
Yeah.
So the offshoot of the Loose Network of Hackers Anonymous, believed to have caused billions of dollars in damage to governments, international banks, corporations, were allegedly led by a shadowy figure identified as Hector Javier Monsegur, working under the internet alias Sabu. The unemployed 28-year-old father of two allegedly commanded a loosely organized international team of perhaps thousands of hackers from his nerve center in a public housing project on New York's Lower East Side.
He is not far from that. Yeah.
And I think it's pronounced Sabot. Sabot is the type of shoe that the French workers threw into the machines.
Oh, interesting.
To stop the machines from working, thus the term sabotage. Mm. So that's a... That's where this guy gets his thing situation.
Well, yeah. It's spelled S-A-B-U, so yeah. I have no
Everyone's
idea.
Always been pronouncing it Sabu, so I think you're thinking about this more than he did, Wayne.
that always happens.
But,
if I was a hacker, I would think a lot about my handle. Like, what is my handle going to be?
This is true.
I have to say that I don't know if I'm surprised that he's been secretly working with the FBI. You know what it
that's
feels to me?
They've been on his ass. They probably found him 8
that's
months ago.
That's
and
exactly
they had like a plea deal.
You know?
Yeah. That's exactly what it feels like to me. Is they had his balls up against the wall, and they said, you know what, if you don't turn over,
we will take your kids and make them prostitutes.
And he
China,
pretty much like sweated it out and kowtowed immediately.
Yeah.
They will do anything to you to get, like, I mean, the whole law enforcement principle is, like, the only way to get ahead is to, like, arrest people with big names. So they were like, we will take your kids and make them make iPhones in China if you don't do what I say. And he was like, okay.
Yeah.
He got doxxed, though, I think 2 months ago or a while. No, I think he actually – I was reading something on Ars Technica about how he had actually been outed by Anonymous almost actually before he even took over LulzSec.
Huh.
So, I don't know, there's some question about how much people actually know. By the way, crazy thing.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about Anonymous and this sort of secretive hacker organization. Like, you can go onto their IRC channel and just, like, watch them. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my coworkers just was like, I wonder. And he just decided on his IRC client and just found it. And, like, here they are just talking in public. Like, that's... I mean, I'm sure they have, like, secret channels for talking where – because I'm sure law enforcement, there's a dude.
Right. Have you ever seen 24, sure. Chris? Have you ever seen an episode of 24?
No.
Okay, so there's a girl named Chloe. Make sure you can back me up on this. Chloe sits there, and she's, like, with a little headset in, and she's on the computer, and she goes, Jack, I'm hearing all these things on chatter. Like, I'm hearing all this chatter about whatever. That's Chloe right there listening.
That's
to
her job.
Not a mystery.
Chatter.
All those things.
Such a ridiculous show.
Exactly.
All right. Moving on here. recently, there's been chatter that Valve, the company behind the massively popular gaming service Steam, has been considering getting into the hardware business. Specifically, there have been rumors that the company's been toying with the idea of creating a proper set-top console, which could potentially pose a threat to the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3. Valve co-founder Gabe Newell said, well, if we have to sell hardware, we will. According to sources, the company's been working on a hardware spec and associated software which would make up the backbone of a Steam box.
That's awesome, a Steam box.
Yes.
Oh, that would be pretty cool.
Yes.
That's awesome. I think they would do well to go, if they're going to go ahead and do this, they might as well go and say, hey, Apple, I know you've got an Apple TV device. What's your next iteration like? What can we do to make our games work on that? And then that's the end of the world.
The thing about the Steam Box, from what I've been gathering, is, though, it's essentially just – it's not there are no kind of unique specialized parts. It's basically kind of like a spec build. Yeah, of something that anybody could put together, from what I understand. I think the one thing that
made the Xbox and Xbox 360.
No, the Xbox isn't a spec. The Xbox is an actual dedicated device. What he's saying is that if what Andy's saying is correct, then what we'll see is that Steam could license out the technology to any, like much like an Android phone, like a reference phone, like the Nexus, mm-hmm. or like the way that Microsoft does the Windows telephones, and say,
yeah.
This is what we need to give you the SDK or the operating system. You need this to be in your device, and after that, it just goes. So you can have a Steam Box from Roku. You can have a Steam Box from some other company.
As we all know, that worked out very well for 3DO, right? You know,
I don't know. I'm saying, like, in this day and age, when the parts are cheap and the power is easy. I mean, Microsoft and Sony are running. Everyone was making this joke about how the iPad 3 was like, oh, it's so much more powerful than the Xbox and the PS3. That's because those devices are 6 years old. They're 6 years old and they work perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean like OnLive or Valve can get behind some specification and say, look, you can build your own and we'll like lease it to you and like license
this. Yeah, this sounds different because the whole point with OnLive is that you don't really need much local hardware. This one is all about having like a, you know, good choice local CPU and lots of RAM and a GPU and everything. So I don't know, it's interesting, but it seems like maybe a little too late for something like a Steam Box.
Like, to be honest, I think I like the OnLive model better.
The OnLive model is amazing because the thing is, our internet access is only going to get better, and OnLive actually works pretty damn good right now. It's the sort of thing that, you know, TV companies could just put into their sets because it is all software. It's just software that communicates with their servers. So that's the thing that could easily and instantly revolutionize gaming. This seems like Valve is looking at the industry 5 years ago and, you know, trying to jump in.
I don't think it's going to be difficult to use like relatively legacy technology to, cheap technology to get the games that Valve is running right now on Steam into a set-top box. The only problem is, Steam is so focused on the mouse and keyboard. I'm not really sure how effective it'll be
most of the popular Steam games are on consoles too. So why is somebody going to do this versus, you know, just buying an Xbox, or they probably already have an Xbox?
I will admit though, if
Xbox is at the Xboxes. Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
If Valve makes this Steam Box in the shape of a companion cube, I would be awfully tempted.
Oh. I'd buy it just for a decoration. It'd be $500.
Is this what they're doing instead of giving us episode 3? Because seriously, I want to punch somebody. wasting time, Val.
Part of this is that I just feel like these guys, if they can find a way to have other people make their hardware and just license the tech, Android style, then they have possibly a viable solution, at least for the short term. I mean, all the consoles are ready, like, you know, the PS3 and the Xbox are ready. They're ripe for a late 2012, mid 2013 refresh, if that's what's going to happen. So
it sounds like next year, judging from all the chatter on the internet.
Regardless of what, like, rumors are, in terms of what the hardware is capable of doing, just a statistical analysis of what the hardware is capable of doing and how far the software has come, they are ripe for a refresh at the end of this year, toward the middle of next year. And I'm saying that Valve then has an opportunity to enter its own hardware in that can compete. Or, even better, let companies know today, in early 2012, that they want to enter their own hardware in to compete, running Valve's badge or whatever Valve wants to get in the Valve software. Then they can do that. Like, from a business opportunity, from a more open like opportunity than making like a dedicated integrated box, there is the ability for other companies to create, like a Dell or an HP, to create a Valve box with some value added services on top of it. I'm not saying it's the best model, but I can see how it would be effective in the marketplace.
All right, and our last headline of the week, created by Boston Dynamics. The cheetah is allegedly now the fastest-legged robot on the planet. DARPA released a video this week showing a cheetah running at various speeds on a laboratory treadmill ultimately hitting its maximum speed of 18 miles per hour. This breaks the previous land speed record of 13.1 miles per hour. Engineers designed the cheetah bot by patterning its movements after the real cheetah, such as its namesake. By flexing and flexing its spine, the four-legged droid is able to lengthen its stride and increase its running speed. Boston Dynamics said that there's no reason that why the robot can't go as fast as a real cheetah, up to 70 miles per hour. And DARPA plans to test a free-running prototype of the cheetah later this year. It's a little frightening. Did you guys see this video?
This is great, dude. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, like, the soldiers coming back without legs and stuff, they can, you know, think, like, they can dream. You know, like, if this robot can do it, then there's no reason why they can't make an interface for a human to do it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's rather than just having two stilts that come out of your decapitated knees that allow you to, like, kind of win in a race but not be able to stand up straight, this sounds good. Like, this sounds like they're using, you know, just like when we look at nano-based technologies or other, like, you know, AI that focus on the way our brains work or whatever. Look to nature, see what you can do, and, like, move forward. This is good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I herald the advance in technology, but it feels to me like Boston Dynamics is single-handedly creating, like, Skynet. Like, they're great.
Well, all these companies with dynamics in their name, has Fringe taught us nothing?
Yes.
Guys, come on.
They're creating the robot army that will eventually destroy the human race.
Exactly.
Cylons.
There's also a General Dynamics too, I think.
Right.
That's a real company. General Dynamics is a real company.
They make that one of our friends works with.
All right. So we're going to take a break, but before we do, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook that we're going to recommend this week, I actually checked out on Audible. They don't actually have it in the U.S. Available, but I'm gonna pass it over to Dwayne to talk a little bit about it, because he's actually read this book. And it, maybe with enough attention, Audible can get it to their store, and we can get them to publish it on, make it available in the U.S.
Right, right. It's called The Terror of Living. It's a great, it's an incredible book. It's by Urban Waite. It came out 2011, so it's pretty new. And what it is basically there's a main character, and he suddenly gets involved between a hitman and the law enforcement that thinks that he's the guy who did it, who did the deed. And he has to figure out who he trusts, how he trusts these people, and basically how to get out of this situation. It's brilliant. It's visceral. It's terrifying. And it's called The Terror of Living, not for no reason. and it's a good book. It's done well. And I don't know. Like, I've read it, the paper version. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to hear the Audible version, because they do a good job of getting great readers that push you to the sort of, like, a dramatic limit of what the book can do. So as a recent Audible subscriber, I'm gonna pick up this one too. And I gotta say, I'm down. I was moved. Urban Waite is a good writer, and this was his first novel. He's a young author, so I look forward to seeing what else, you know, people like him, Phil Tucker, a couple other guys can really pull off. So it's he's just good, and it's a good book. And I couldn't put my Kindle down. just couldn't put it down.
Although we cannot yet download this book via our local Audible, perhaps with enough attention, Audible will make it available. There are over 100,000 plus titles that you can download on Audible. And all you have to do that is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook plus free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. So we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we come back, it's going to be all about the iPod, baby. I mean, all about the iPad, all about Apple TV. And iOS 5.1, we're going to really get into it. So,
wait, Apple had an announcement today? What was that about?
So take a listen to this and come on back. Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar, Dwayne DeFreitas, and Christopher Brunar. And let's talk about today's Apple announcement. First of all, let's start with what they... Let's go in order of what they announced. Following... the first thing they announced off the bat was iOS 5.1. Which will have Japanese language support for Siri. Photos can be now deleted from the photo stream.
It adds this really nice swipe-up thing on the lock screen, mm-hmm. so you can get to your camera immediately. I love it.
I don't think it's any better than what was there before. In fact, I think
it's totally better, because before you had to double-click, and only people who knew how to double-click on the home button to get to that button.
Anyone who's ever used the mouse knows how to double-click.
No, that's not a valid UI excuse. Come on. You need to have a button visible so everybody can see.
I think you're just drinking the Kool-Aid on that one, buddy. And as a Guyanese person, really? You know what I mean. Yeah, I think that a double click is difficult.
Invisible buttons? Come on.
It also makes it more confusing because double clicking has a different effect on the phone.
Yeah.
Double clicking on the phone will open up your recently used tab. So, like, it's an inconsistent experience.
Double clicking on the phone doesn't do any of that.
No, well, double clicking on the iPhone gets you to.
Your recently used apps is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like now I have to do a click and then a swipe, and it's like a lot of work. Like I feel like
so much work for Dwayne. I used to
be able to just double click. I guess it's still.
It is not any more work. It is
it's
not
two
any
motions
work.
Instead of one motion. I'll give you that. It's two motions instead of three motions. I'll give you that.
Redesigned camera app for the iPad. Camera face detection. Genius mixes and Genius playlists for iTunes Match subscribers. Other bugs and fixes.
Battery fixes too.
Yeah. Well, also, I thought that the rumor that I heard that I was most excited about was the fact that iPhone 4S users were able to go to the network place in the settings and manually turn off 3G and go to Edge. Like you used to be able to in iOS 4, but mm-hmm. that did not return, and that is painful to me.
That sucks. That is a feature that I think they're trying to get back, just not for this version.
But now, also the big kahuna, guys, the big kahuna, is that AT&T has acknowledged that they believe HSPA Plus is 4G.
They haven't acknowledged. They've always said it was 4G.
Fine, Apple. Has acknowledged that, or it's made Apple acknowledge that. The bottom line is, with 5.1, if you're running 14.4 HSPA Plus, your phone will say 4G.
Basically just the iPhone 4S. But now it says 4G instead of 3G.
Exactly. Which my girlfriend is not happy about, because she's like, now I really need a new phone. I want a 4S. I'm like, no, you have to wait till the next phone comes out.
That's what they want.
The next thing they announced was a refreshed version of the Apple TV set-top box with support for 1080p video streaming.
Should not be a big like that. That should have been there in the first place. Like this Apple TV. Like I love the fact that they made a new Apple TV and that was $100 instead of $300. But this current Apple TV, this is what we were waiting for.
Roku had 1080p streaming. They had 5.1 at the time. You know, the last Apple TV came out, so there was no excuse for the 720p limitation.
Yeah, I mean, like I think the iPhone 4 chip, the A4, I think it could. I don't know how badly it wouldn't be able to handle it. I don't know what the limitations were. I think that's the only reason why they didn't do it. But if they could have squeezed out a couple more, you know, bits of cash, megahertz, whatever, to get that 1080p on there, it would have been like worth the wait, given the first Apple TV and how it was. I just feel like it could have been worth the wait just to get...
That was actually the second Apple TV, let's not forget.
Right,
The one that's... Given the previous
version.
Given the previous Apple TV, you know, this was...
This, by the way, is the problem with not having a version number on your products. Let's just be clear.
Right. Yeah. Okay, there's a little bit more about that coming up in the next...
I disagree. Because they call it the Apple TV 2, and I think that's where the problem came up. Not because...
Not really. That was never a name that was used very much.
Yeah, it's really only ever been Apple TV.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I don't remember it being Apple TV 2.
Yeah.
Or at least some sort of version number like they do with the iPhone mm-hmm. 4 or iPhone 4.
So let's go into the version number. So the big thing here is that the iPad that was released today, the early 2012 iPad, doesn't have a name like iPad 3 or iPad HD. And all the tech bloggers are like, we know what it's going to be called. It's going to be called the iPad HD. Fuck them. The idea here is that Apple had the first iDevice was the iPod. The iPod never had any marker on it except for maybe the size.
You mean iPod Touch?
They made separate brands. You're not listening to me. They made separate brands of iPod. But you'll never – like the original iPod, the jukebox version with the hard drive was always the iPod. It became the iPad Classic later. But it was never called like the iPod 1 or the iPod 2. The iPod Nano was never called the iPod Nano 1 or the iPod Nano 2. There were several Nanos. There were a couple Minis. A couple Minis. Mm-hmm. There was a Classic. But none of them were ever demarked by which version they were – other than by individuals.
Sure, but you're going back here a long time. Like, the problem
going back to the year 2000 when the first iDevice came out.
Well, now, the problem is what people are comparing it to.
I'm also going to go to the iMac and the MacBook Pros.
You're talking about older products.
Let me lay this out. You can destroy it all you want later. What I'm saying is when you buy a 15-inch MacBook Pro, you don't buy a 15-inch MacBook Pro that is like the MacBook Pro 4, the MacBook Pro 5. You don't buy an iMac that's the iMac 7 or the iMac HD or whatever. You buy an iMac you buy a Mac Mini and you buy these devices that don't have numbers associated with it. The first time we saw these associations was when Apple was getting into the phone market and they had to figure ways to distinguish the previous phone from the last phone, especially because mobile moves so much faster than any device they'd ever released before. So they made the iPhone. That's great. Then they made the iPhone 3G because it had 3G and that was a big distinguishing factor and they had to get into this space. 3GS, not a big deal, whatever. The 4, it was the fourth iPhone. Then they made the 4S, which is the fifth iPhone. And then people were like, oh, well, the next iPhone is going to be the iPhone 5. And maybe it will be, but it will be the sixth iPhone in terms of what it really is. All I'm saying is that if you look at the data, Apple traditionally has not named their products with a sequential modifier at the end of its name. It's the data, the actual data, as opposed to what you want to believe or what your heart set on, shows that Apple has a product and that product gets refreshed. If you want to look at your MacBook Air, you might you need to take it in for service. The MacBook Air might say MacBook Air, you know, mid 2010. You have to look at when you got it, not like MacBook Air 2. That's all I'm saying.
You're looking at data like a robot, and let's look at logic, okay? So I don't know when it ever makes sense to name your brand new product the same thing as the very first version of this product. Okay, if you set the precedent if you set the precedent for numbering your products, it sort of makes sense to like either continue in that vein, because what they started with the iPhone is a yearly refresh. something major happening every year. So they have, they need to have a way to like demarcate that and make that clear. That was never exactly true with the MacBooks and the iPods and everything. It was like, you know, with the iPods, it was, you know, it got a little thinner. You know, maybe they added more storage. It wasn't, there weren't huge yearly differences. Now there are, though. And it definitely seems like you need a way to clearly delineate that. So it seems like we're going to be really confused come next year when it comes
to the new iPad. Do you know why retail typically has numbers behind it? It's because things like the Roomba 560, the Roomba 570, the Roomba 580. What they do is the people who manufacture often sell by third parties. So you sell a Roomba in Bed Bath & Beyond. You sell a Roomba in Best Buy. You sell them wherever. You distinguish the actual devices by whom it is selling them with these numbers. And you do that because you want the consumer to be relatively confused as to what the difference is between them, so the consumer goes to the easiest place for them, and these stores all benefit from that.
But Apple doesn't
Since Apple is the only place selling this product, the Apple like store staff, they look at what you brought in, or they look at what you're interested in, and they don't have the barrier of saying, oh, that's a 560, it wasn't purchased here, or whatever. They have the ability to sit back and say, This is I know what this product is. It's the iPad, sure. When I look at the back of your iPad, it doesn't say iPad 2. It looks at the back of the iPhone, it doesn't say iPhone 4, iPhone 4S. That's just kind of how it is. And I think that's what, and this is what I think part of a bigger return to what I think that Apple, in the wake of Steve Jobs' death, is actually looking to find a way to kind of put themselves in a more to go back to roots and not make a whole bunch of waves and changes, as opposed to what some bloggers said today, that Apple is just they don't know what they're doing and their branding is all off. I think they're actually going back to certain roots. And as much as you might say they set a precedent by calling it iPad 2, that was a small aberration in the actual overall marketing plan of the way Apple names its devices.
Again, but you were going back really far to look at very different devices. As far as mobile devices go, you know, iPhone was, and what the iPad is basically the offshoot of iOS. That's what we were expecting. Now, the thing is, I don't have a big problem with it, although... hear me out. I was definitely one of the people also that thought that the iPad HD seemed like a legitimate name. I reported on it because I've heard it from a really good source, and then I've talked to at least 4 or 5 different developers over the past week who are like, yeah, it's totally going to be iPad HD. That's what we're hearing. That's what we're working with. So either like that was just an internal name that they were dealing with initially. You know, it could have been just internal. It could have been an early name that was changed at some point. The thing is, that name makes sense because the whole crux of this device is its Retina display.
Right.
You know, it has a crazy, I think it's like 2048 by 1563 display.
Yep.
That's higher than 1080p video. This device is built for 1080p and for high resolution work. So that clearly seems like you can call the iPad HD and get away with it. Mm-hmm. It seems clear.
You can get away with it, but I'm saying, like, I look at my iPad 2 box. I look at my iPad 2. The only reason why I refer to it as the iPad 2 is because they marketed it as such. You can look at an iPhone 3GS, an iPhone 4, an iPhone 4S, and the only reason why you'd call it whatever you're calling it is because of the marketing. The actual device bears no mark says.
Dwayne, I feel like from a technical standpoint that you're correct, but from on a purely marketing standpoint,
you're talking to the guy who works in advertising.
Yeah,
here,
but so I'm coming to this.
I'm the expert in advertising on this panel.
I'm coming to you from a consumer's perspective.
That's the thing.
And from a consumer's perspective, yes. I was a little confused at the fact that it's just the iPad.
The thing is, and this is what we get into now with other Apple computers, right? So you have a MacBook Air. You know, you and your buddy have a MacBook Air. Which one? You know, you could be like, oh, it's the MacBook Air from, I guess I bought it in 2010, or maybe I bought the first MacBook Air. If you're looking up like a device used or something, like when people sell MacBook Pros, it's like, you know, late to 2010 or something. Mm-hmm. That to me seems like a much more confusing way to designate products because you don't know what's exactly in there, especially for those sorts of things. It's really confusing. And from a marketing angle, it does kind of make sense to have just a new name that people.
This is what happens with Dell, with HP. I have an HP Envy 15 because HP was like, hey, you know, I wanna make a confusing name like the Dell Studio XPS 15 or the Dell Studio XPS whatever or the HP DV623. But because they wanted to move in an Apple-like direction and say, look, there's an Envy 14-inch. There's an Envy 15-inch. In fact, there was an Envy 15-inch before the current Envy 15-inch. And my generation of the 14-inch wasn't sitting in the middle. This, like, there's a time for alphanumerics, whether it's the iPad 3 or the iPad HD or the iPad, like, you know, iPhone 3GS. And I think that Apple has walked away from that in an attempt to distinguish itself, in an attempt for the relative simplicity. Again, if you need... if you have a question about your device and you go into a store, the people who are at the store can look at your device immediately and know what it is you have. All I'm saying is that this is, again, one of those things. When the iPad first came out, Chris DeVinci and I were like, yeah, this is basically a big iPod Touch, whatever, because we kind of didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Now we get it, the device itself. And I'm thinking that I think that Apple is getting itself in terms of understanding what it is they want to promote about the product. This is the iPad. There's an iPad 2, yeah, but I think over time we'll see, you know, another iPad that comes out in 2013 and 14 and 15. And they're going to say things like it breaks up the latitude. So they don't necessarily have to wait for a whole year. They can be like, this is the iPad early 2011. And this is the iPad late 2011.
That would be so infuriating. By the way, if they started doing more than once a year releases of the iPad.
It gives them latitude. It gives them options. It's like a girl with a whole bunch of guys who like her. They're keeping their options open.
You're talking about like just the name in terms of somebody going in to get their device serviced. I'm more talking about when somebody wants to buy one of these devices, because that's the key. That's the first problem.
You buy the current one. That's the whole point of Apple. You always buy the current one.
Not necessarily.
Well, you assume you're buying the current one. But you go into, like, you can go either to like a reseller now, like Best Buy or something. Are you absolutely sure you're going to get the new one? And then you ask the salesperson. They're like, oh yeah, it's the new iPad. But you know, sometimes people get confused. Like it's one of those things where you get a dumb salesperson and they just give you what was the old stock or something. It just seems confusing in a way, but there's more to talk about.
Let's move away from the discussion of the nomenclature and talk about the device itself.
Yeah.
So,
2048 by 1530, like 36 resolution. It's got, you know, normal 16, 32, and 64 gigabyte capacities. It comes in flavors of Verizon and AT&T if you want the broadband connectivity when you're not attached to Wi-Fi.
LTE is the key difference. So and LTE for the first time, yeah.
LTE is a key difference here. Instead of the 3G versions that were the original iPad and the iPad 2, you have LTE here. If you go for the Verizon one, you have a choice. Like if the depending on the network you're on, we'll put where you are in the coverage. Verizon will give you EVDO 3.1, which is 3G for Verizon's network, and it'll give you LTE, which is a 4G for Verizon's network. Mm-hmm. If you're on the AT&T device, you get normal HSPA, which is the 3G. You get HSPA Plus if you are in an area that will pick that up, which is for some people 3G, for some people 4G. We can get into that later. And then you get 4G LTE if you're in a place that supports that too. So the AT&T one has a bit more gradation when – that's the wrong word. It has a bit more gradient when it comes to the speed you're getting based on where you are.
Although that's more related to their networks. Like that's – I don't know. That's a really technical problem.
It's a thing, but you get
the other
set, like you get all this stuff, and then there's the what is it, the chip is the A5
the A5X chip, which is really it's sort of interesting too because it's slightly faster than last year's A5, but it has quad core graphics capabilities, but it doesn't have a quad core CPU. So Apple was very very clear like about how they were positioning this chip. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the Tegra 3 or something, which is like a legitimate quad core chip. This one just has better graphics, but it seems like much better graphics.
Because I know a techie who was sitting there and said, wow, I'm so happy that they have a quad-core chip. And I was like, dude, no. Because if they had a quad-core chip, they would say, we have a quad-core chip. Instead, they said, we have an A5X. It's the A5. It has quad-core graphics, whatever that means. If you had a true quad-core chip, you would market the hell out of that. You'd be like,
it means the GPU is better, basically, but not the actual processing power.
And why is the GPU better?
But that may make a huge difference anyway.
It definitely will make a huge difference.
Why is the GPU? Why does it need to be better?
For the games and for the 1080p, because let's be clear here. This is a device running a crazy-ass resolution. Mm-hmm. Okay, like if a computer ran this resolution, you would be hard pressed to like play a normal game on it or something. Like you need a lot of horsepower for this. And we didn't talk much about the display, but the display is kind of crazy. Like that's I've never really felt like a reason to compel me to buy an iPad before. But the thing about the Retina display on this is that you can't get this anywhere else, right? You can't get this resolution, this fidelity on like just your laptop or another computer or even like a computer monitor. Mm-hmm. Because
you have to get a cinema display that runs 2500 by 1600 to beat this. You'd have to get a cinema display or a Dell like.
But even then, those are much, much bigger displays. So like having this resolution squashed into like the 9.7 inches that the iPad is, that just means a whole ton of fidelity. And it opens up the iPad to be a really useful device for, like for viewing movies and photos. But just with a sharper screen than we've ever seen in any computing device. That's what really excites me about
this. Aside from like the cinema display based, like, you know, MacBook Pros or whatever.
No, not even those. It's not, it's sharper than those.
It's, well, yeah, you're right. It is in some way sharper. I would say that one of the things here that it kind of brings us back to the way it kind of used to be, right? It used to be that you looked at your television set with 500 lines and your computer that was running 1600 by 1200 was so much sharper. And then we got to this place where we hit this 1920 by 1080 spot. And then everything was 1920 by 1080. Your laptop was, your TV, everything was the same resolution. That was pretty much the standard unless you wanted to pay a lot more money to get to 1900 by 1200 or 2500 by 1600 on the cinema displays or the 30-inch Dell display. This used to be the standard to have a computing device that was a higher resolution than your entertainment device. Now we've got this device that's kind of a computer, kind of entertainment, that has the highest resolution and definitely the best like pixels per inch that we've seen from a 15-inch from your face standpoint. So they're kind of, again, kind of changing a paradigm, either shifting it back or shifting it forward. I'm not sure, but I think it's definitely compelling. And DaVinci's absolutely right when he says this is a compelling reason to pick up the device.
There's also going to be a new camera, 5-megapixel camera. It's a slightly lower resolution sensor, but apparently the same 5-element lens and hybrid IR filter that's in the iPhone 4S.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like this was a hybrid between the 5-megapixel iPhone 4 camera and the super lensed up iPhone 4S camera? I feel like
that's
it felt
like
a hybrid. Yeah.
It's it can record HD movies at 1080p. It features voice dictation, which isn't the same as Siri. And I'm not sure if...
Well, it's just like one aspect of Siri, but it doesn't have the whole assistant part.
It's not the whole suite.
Do you think Siri will eventually come to the iPad?
It has to.
Yeah, I think what they're waiting for is the system on a chip has to be just right. And I also think that they're trying to figure out a way to make Siri compelling on the iPad. Like, it's supposed to be compelling on the phone. I don't know if it is. We can all have a debate about that. But I think they're looking at the iPad as a place where your mouth is farther away from it, and I think that's the problem. The reason why we haven't had Siri on like a new refresh of Macs is that your Mac is farther away from it. Your mouth, rather, is farther away from the Mac or the iPad than it is from the iPhone.
Is that really a problem? Because the microphones built into your Mac are built to get your voice from you sitting at a normal distance.
So the reason why Siri has been limited to the 4S so far, everything that I've been able to understand, is because the audio decoding on the system on a chip is heavily focused on being able to decode your voice in English, whether it's, you know, American English or English, and now Scottish English, to get like the content out of you and figure out what it is. A big part of that is your proximity to the microphone. And even though the Mac microphones have been designed to pick up your voice, they haven't been designed to pick up your voice in the way that Siri has been designed to work. So for right now, and I really mean for right now, I think they're working on this feverishly to get it to as many devices as possible. They haven't quite been able to put in the pipeline, in the production devices, a way for Siri to effectively pick up your voice, decode it, work with what it is you're trying to say, and get it from the microphone standpoint when it's not right against your mouth like it is when you're using a phone. Well, and I think the big things about that is that Siri works fine for what it's for a beta, and I remind everyone, it's still a beta. It's not the most robust, awesome thing. I'm able to use it when I'm snowboarding for my Bluetooth helmet, and I like that a lot. But again, you ask Siri some questions, and it has no idea what you're saying. And I think one of the things that's gone in here is that the iPhone 4S is the best possible scenario for Siri to work. And once you get that mic away from your mouth, it's not as good a scenario. So Apple exposes itself by running Siri here to having a product that doesn't run as nicely as they'd like it to run. Again, it's out of
beta. I'm not sure if I agree with you entirely there, because so I bought a I can't even remember the brand name of it, which is terrible, but I bought a hands-free device for my phone, for my car, and granted that has a different microphone that's sort of designed for working further away, but I mean that thing is generally like 2 or 3 feet away from my mouth and then being transferred from that into Bluetooth. And
it's not about that, though.
Fine.
It's about what the, it's not about like when you're talking to me on the telephone. It's about what it is.
No, but you use Siri. I mean, that's how I use it. Like what you do is you hold down the button on it and then it puts on Siri, and then Siri does all your voice commands. So like I hold down the button on the hands-free device and I say, Siri, do I have any new text messages?
How far is your – all right. So I mean like that's a dedicated like mic that's designed to be 2 or 3 feet away from your mouth. I'm not sure that the mic in the iPad is has the fidelity without connecting something else to it, an external mic, a mic like the one you're talking about, that allows that kind of fidelity. And that's all I'm saying.
I mean, like, I guess. It's just it does. I haven't been particularly impressed with the mic on it. It just, I don't know. It that seems like an odd limitation.
We actually do know that the iPhone 4S has like a good audio chip, for decoding for wind noise.
Maybe
and whatnot.
It's the audio chip, yeah.
But the thing is, like, there was no reason that couldn't be in the new iPad either. So I think, like, from what it seems mostly,
well, they have a good audio
series being marketed right now is like this really, really compelling reason to get the iPhone 4S. And the minute you take that off, you kind of lose that luster a little. So the new iPad will likely get a software update for Siri by the end of the year or something.
That would not be surprising. Mm-hmm. Has there been any talk about whether or not there's NFC support on?
No.
There's not.
No. Apple doesn't care about NFC at all, apparently. So.
Well, they just got a patent about it this morning. Yes, so
they get a lot of patents. Is the thing. They do. If you read Patently Apple, they get a lot of patents for crazy shit that will never happen.
But it also
they get them.
It also shows that when they Patently Apple might report on a patent yesterday, like they did, but that means that it's going to be a while before we see it in a device. Apple typically gets that patent, works on that thing, works on it, continues to work on it, and then and only then does it show up in production. So if Patently Apple saw that patent show up yesterday, then we may not see that device until the iPhone, the iPad, like, you know, the next iPad, the iPad in 2013. So that's all I'm saying.
Like, it's just unfortunate that it's not there, because I mean that's another avenue that sort of opens up a whole new world of what can happen on iOS devices.
It does have Bluetooth 4.0, which apparently has all sorts of new interaction. Yeah.
And do you guys think the iPad is the best place to debut NFC? Are you going to pull your iPad out of your bag and be like,
no, use it in reverse? The iPad replaces the cash register.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what Square is doing with their new iPad for taxis in New York City, where you can – Square sort of will basically give you this device if you're a taxi driver that's basically an iPad, and they use it for payment processing. I mean, something like that would be spectacular for lots of small business owners that are you know, quite possibly going to own an iPad anyway, and then they can use – honestly, I almost wonder if Apple is planning on coming up with its own payments processing platform.
Oh, there's a lot of evidence for that too. Because,
and they probably don't want to put the technology into it until they can be the ones to do it right.
Yeah, they don't want to put the open source. They want to put the hardware in there, and they want to have the software surrounding it and the platform and the APIs and all that stuff, because they want to control that message.
Yeah.
Apple also introduced a brand new iPhoto for iPad, which is basic photo editing, but it looks really fantastic. I mean, really, it's leaps and bounds above anything they've had before. And I think, especially with the Retina, screen, this is like perfect application for this.
It's also a big deal because they started this talk about leading a movement in a post-PC world. And the one, I think, compelling consumer product that they don't have on the iPad is iPhoto. My only question about that is, if I've got, you know, I've got a couple terabytes of photos now because I'm a photo enthusiast, you know, I can't I can't use my 64 gigabyte iPad to hold those. Now, for the regular consumer, they might have less than 64 gigabytes of photos, but since the photo age has kind of been, let's just say that good, cheap, small cameras, let's just, like, you know, be generous, say they came out in 2007, people have a lot of gigabytes of photos. So I don't really know how this program on this device can really replace the PC in terms of storage, unless they're going to, you know, heavily link iPhoto with iCloud storage services. They have to heavily link those two, make it blatant, make it a part of the application, so that people are like, oh yeah, so I have iPhoto and whatever, and I'll just pay Apple $5 more to hold all my photos or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be some way to make it so the storage is just as compelling as the interface.
Let's talk a minute about the actual announcement itself, the actual keynote itself, and particularly Tim Cook's performance at it. What did you guys think about the show, the announcement?
Like, how did you guys see video of it? Did you see him talking and walking? Or did you guys
I saw video of it. It's actually online right now. And but you can gather this. Like, I felt you can gather this even from if you were looking at live blogs, that it was very kind of short and sweet. It didn't have a lot of flash. It was straight to the point.
No one more thing, you know?
No one more thing, no boom,
they could
no.
have done that first with the iPad and then gotten one more thing with the Apple TV, right? But they didn't do that.
Right. Right. It was a very kind of subdued, straight to the point presentation. And I think that's probably – I mean, this is probably going to be the direction that Apple goes with its announcements from here on out.
I'm guessing they will. I mean, Jobs was Jobs, and until somebody else comes along in their organization who can pull off what he did, it would be – it's better to just not do it than to do it poorly.
Why try to be Jobs when you can just say this product is awesome? Let the product speak for itself.
Yeah. That's why I really disagree with that VentureBeat article today about Apple's brand unraveling.
Oh, by
I mean, unraveling?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going in a different direction.
Yeah.
It's going a different direction, but it's just not even really that surprising. Apple goes in a different direction every 2 years. Sometimes they stick with it. Sometimes you get the iPod 3G, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, that's terrible, and they leave it. They try new things. Sometimes, you know, they're
wildly popular.
Sometimes
you get an iPhone every June. Sometimes you get an iPhone that's randomly 15 months later in October. The article that you're referencing, I thought was kind of off the mark, especially when it came to the name of the device and when it came to, like, the idea that they're, like, not focused or whatever. They're a focused company. I think they're more focused than they've ever been because they have to, because they're afraid. And because the stock market, the analysts are like, dude, your growth is so crazy that we're pissed off you didn't tell us that you were selling this many devices, so we couldn't analyze things and give you, like, a better stock price, whatever. And then they make so much money on a regular basis that if they don't grow by X percentage, then they're going to get downgraded or some craziness like that. And they're showing in some ways with their success that the normal market analysis of what they do isn't applicable. So I think that they're really focused on making sure that everything can be as regular and as predictable and as nuanced as possible, and that they're not really focusing on, they're not sweating the small stuff, like, you know, whether or not their brand is falling apart. Like, that, I just don't think that's
well, it wasn't the brand is falling apart necessarily. It's just, like, this consistent image that Apple used to portray is changing in a way that you guys are saying. Did you catch the thing about the new Apple logo? It was like a brief showing of this really new colorful logo. We reported on it because it was just like, is this the new Apple logo? It does look like it could be. It seems like professional enough. Mm-hmm. But they didn't, like, it's weird that they would just show that off and then they'd still have their normal branding all over the place. It's weird to see that thing happening. It's weird to have a new product that's called the same as your old product.
Mm-hmm. This is again taking it back. They're taking it back, guys. I really think that they're trying to.
Well, no, I'm saying you can like, you know, you can rationalize this, sure, to be in favor of Apple. That's fine, but there are certainly things that you could bring up that could be like, this is strange, and you can. I don't see any reason.
Is it strange? Or is it new? I don't think strange is necessarily new. Like, it would be strange if they got up and they had like a band started off instead of like ending it like Steve Jobs. I don't know. Like I think that I look at that new logo, what might be a new logo, and I think that looks eerily like the first logo. And I look at the new name and I think that reminds me of the way they name everything else. And I look at a couple other things and I'm like, that reminds me of kind of how they used to do things. I think on some level, in the wake of Jobs being gone, this is just a theory and it's not a prediction. It's not anything. It's just like looking at the data and like making a conclusion based on that data. It looks to me as if it's possible that in the wake of Jobs being gone, they're trying to find a way to connect to the roots that got them where they are today. Instead of kind of going, Jobs had the ability to move Apple in a new direction in some respect because he was always Apple. But when that guy's gone, you kind of run back home to mama, like in the Hunt for Red October and the software that chased the other submarines. And you figure out what it is that's the core, and then you work from there. That's all I'm saying. That could be what's going on. I'm not saying that is what's going on, but that could be what's going on.
Let's wrap this up here. Any last words anybody want to say about the iPad before we close?
Oh yeah, one last thing. The iPad, like when the second iPad came out, the original iPad went down to $399 until it was no longer available. Right now, they specifically stated that the second iPad will be around indefinitely. Not unlike the model they're using mm-hmm. for the iPhone 3GS mm-hmm. and the iPhone 4. So the new device comes out. The old device is dropped by $100.
Prices are $499, mm-hmm. $599, and $699 for 16, 32, and 64 gigabyte Wi-Fi. No, this is for the new one. And $629, $729, and $829 for 4G, mm-hmm. respectively.
Yeah. And so those prices are the same. Those are the same. Yeah. Those haven't changed, whatever. My focus is on the fact that the Kindle Fire came out at $200, possibly at a loss, possibly at just a few dollars of margin. But the iPad 2 is going to remain available relatively indefinitely at a $399 or a $400. Let's just call it a $400 price point. So for $400, you get the iPad 2, 16 gigabyte. For $500, you get the iPad 3 or the iPad or whatever you want to call it. For you know 16, and then for 500, you know 600 for 32, and 700 for the Wi-Fi version of the 64, and then you add that 129 on for your GPS and broadband mobile situation. The bottom line is that if you're looking at the Kindle Fire and it's $200, you're like $200 I can pull out. $400 is not that it's double, but it's not a back-breaking amount. It's not half a grand, and I can do this. And it's not a question of me getting it before the volume is gone, before the inventory is out of there. It's a question of that's just how much it costs. So if you're an educational institution and you realize you don't need a crazy high-res display for your students, you know, you've got like fourth graders or something, this becomes a viable option for a lot of people. And I think that given the numbers on how a Kindle Fire is considered mm-hmm. a starter tablet for a lot of people, this becomes a viable option. If they push it down one level further, if the next iPhone comes out in 2013 and they still have the iPad 2 on the market as a $200 device, then we end up seeing the same kind of disruption we saw when the iPhone 3G was $99 or whatever.
All right, let's wrap this up. Before we go, before we move into our final word, we're going to say goodbye to Chris Bernard. You've got an early morning tomorrow.
Extremely early morning tomorrow. I'm going to be going off to South by Southwest.
All right.
So I look forward to telling you guys about that when I come back.
Totally.
Just eat a lot of barbecue, Chris. Just make sure. Okay.
So Chris, where are we going to be able to find you online when you're not here?
Well, the next week it will be whatever the hot app of South by Southwest is. No, I'm kidding. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Bernor, ChrisBurnor, and I'm also co-editing the Startup Digest reading list, which comes out every Friday with what we consider to be the best startup-related articles on the internet.
Uh-huh.
And everything else I do is at ChrisBurnor.com.
Right. Terrific.
Chris, one last question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about Apple purchasing Chomp last week? You worked for Chomp. You know Chomp. What do you think about Apple?
I didn't work
Chomp?
For Chomp. They were my first interview out here.
All right.
So it would have been fun if I had had joined them. Although it would have been ironic if me of all people had been working at Apple. As people know, I don't have the strongest relationship with them, but good for them. Honestly, they've built a really awesome product, and the iStore could really use some attention paid to it. Apple has been adding all sorts of other things to their products, and yet I feel like the Apple Store, the App Store, is not a particularly great experience.
Right.
So yeah, good for them. I'm excited to see what they come up with. Congratulations to Ben.
All right. Good night, Chris. And for the rest of our listeners here, we're going to take a little break here. But when we come back, we'll talk about Windows 8 Consumer Preview. So take a listen to this and come on back.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright, sunshiny day. It's gonna be a bright, sunshiny day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Devinder Hardware and Dwayne DeFreitas. And let's talk about Windows 8 Consumer Preview. Last week, Microsoft released the Windows 8 Consumer Preview, which means anybody can try out their upcoming Windows 8 operating system and give it a spin. And I actually did just that. I installed it as a boot camp OS on my MacBook Air, and I've been playing with it for the last week, and I really like it. I really like the Metro interface, which is kind of like the main draw for this version of the the OS. You know, if I had any sort of like criticism about it, it's that while you can go into a Windows Explorer interface like in previous versions of Windows, I feel like it's really kind of a night and day difference when you've been playing with Metro, and it just kind of hammered home the impression to me that that whole Windows Explorer interface is going away eventually, and that this.
How do you get to the file? I mean, I haven't on an old machine. I haven't played with it much yet because I just put it in yesterday. How do you get to the files in Metro? How do you get to the actual file system in Metro?
Well, when you load up a new program, like I've been installed Steam and a couple other things, and when you load up a new program in Windows Explorer mode, it will create a module for that new program in Windows Metro mode.
But can you get to the actual files? Can you go sit and look at like batch.txt and like, you know, like the, like kind of search?
The thing around. Is that they don't expect you to do that from Windows Metro, because that's not the experience that they want to promote for the Metro interface.
I guess what I'm asking is, you say that Explorer is going away. Windows is kind of focused on a general computing experience, not a tablet or an appliance computing experience. Yeah. So if it's going away, Metro has to supply some level of file system access. So I was just wondering if there was any kind of level of file system access. Or do you think that Metro will eventually have that kind of capability, or there'll be
have the Explorer is the thing.
Right, but I'm saying Andy was saying Metro, like Explorer is going away.
It feels like Explorer is going to be going away. Like they're promoting this Metro interface is going to be from 8 on, that's going to be the de facto interface for Windows.
Yeah. So you're saying there might be a Windows where there's just no Explorer, where you just can't, like you have not a general computing device, but some sort of more iPad.
Maybe in the far future. Like the thing is with ARM, the Windows 8 ARM devices, right? Those can only run Metro apps. They can't run classic x86, x64, or 64-bit. Sorry, Windows
get
app.
To explore. You can get to Explorer in those
Well,
devices.
No, you get to a really stripped down version of Explorer that has like Internet Explorer and some Office apps, and that's it. You can only run those.
File system. No, you can get to the Windows Explorer, the file system.
In the
system.
ARM devices. I'm talking ARM devices here.
As I understand it, I mean, I don't have an ARM device. I don't know if you do. But I feel like the whole point is that you can still get to. And in fact, I read this on a blog that you can still get to Explorer in the ARM devices.
Yeah.
You can't get to like, you know, you can't run an x86 or x64 app, but you can get to Explorer and you can look at the.
What I'm saying is, though, that is going to be less important because looking at the way the file system works in, you know, iOS or iPad or whatever, you don't really know where the files are. They're kind of there just to work with the program. So you're going to have your documents folder. It'll actually be just all your documents because why are you going to, you know, move things all around all these different folders? But you know the actual
I'm just asking, in terms of that, when it comes to Windows and it comes to your guys who are experts, your understanding of where Windows is going, do you see it moving away from general computing and focused on this sort of more appliance like limited computing, no file system access paradigm? Because that sort of sounded like Andy was saying, and I just wanted to know if that's what I don't have an opinion either way. I just wanted to know if that's. That's okay. Where you guys.
Well, I just sort of answered that, so I'm not sure what else you're looking at.
I do feel that's what's going on, and it may not be apparent in this version of Windows because it is easy to access Windows Explorer from this version. But I feel like moving forward, you know, 9 and 10, as things go on, they're going to wean us off of Windows Explorer and onto that Metro, that modular experience.
So you think that in the future, then we'll be kind of living in a world where the general computer just won't exist unless you're running Linux.
Yes.
You won't be able to do general computing.
Yes.
It's all going to be this kind of closeted, limited experience computing.
Not necessarily limited, though, because what Windows 8 is doing isn't limited in the way that iOS is, right? Like, you can still, you know, the Metro programs, yes, you can only get them from the Windows 8 store for now. The real question is, when will legacy Windows apps disappear entirely? And that'll be the point where, you know, computing in Windows has just simplified itself into nothing. I don't know. Like, I don't think that's in Microsoft's best interest necessarily for that
To get rid of the general computing aspect?
Exactly.
That's what you don't think is...
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And we'll have devices with keyboards and mice and touchpads for a long time. And what Windows 8 is built for is to be this like hybrid OS. It can be anything. It can be a tablet OS. It can be, you know, a touchscreen OS for people who just also want a keyboard and mouse. It could be many things, and, you know, it could be anything and everything. And
is this strategy better? Is this strategy better than having, you know, we look at the Microsoft strategy. It's to have the hybrid OS. The Apple strategy is to have a separate OS for the desktop and for the mobile device, but that talk to one another via iCloud in a way that it seems seamless and robust.
Yeah, I think for Microsoft, this seems like a much better choice for Microsoft because, you know, this is a company that's been trying to get into tablets for, what, decades now?
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
There was the Windows for Pen project back
in
the 90s.
I remember that.
There was Windows tablet PCs, you know, in
Windows
the early
XP aughts. Tablet edition, yeah.
All that junk. It was all useless because they were relying on styluses. So now you have, you know, good touchscreen displays. You have this new way of dealing with, basically, thinking of programs as apps, which I think that is another thing that's kind of helping the whole tablet atmosphere.
Can you distinguish that for me? Programs as apps, not programs as. How do you differentiate that?
What do you think about it? Like, what is the difference between using an app store and then the way we used to find programs? Like, we had to go on the web, find this company's website or something, or go to download.com.
Okay, you're just figuring out.
Something.
Okay, so you're distinguishing it by saying that when you call it an app, you're referring to something that's in an ecosystem that allows you to get to the content quickly and via like. Okay, I get what you're saying. I just wanted to ask these questions because I feel like there is a fundamental difference between Windows 8 and the previous paradigms of Windows, and I wanted everyone who's listening to be able to begin to understand the way to distinguish between them, the way to understand, like, literally, like, the drill down of what's different about Windows 8 as opposed to the paradigm that's been before, which has kind of been the same thing since Windows 95. Windows 95 to Windows 7, it's kind of been the same thing, but Windows 8 represents a fundamentally different experience between Metro, between regular or general computing, that people would call it, and specialized computing.
It's a fundamentally hybrid. New desktop like situation entirely. Like it's not like Linux. It's not like OS X. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like not like anything that we've seen before from Microsoft or from any tech company, which is why I find it so fascinating. And I'm like it seems pretty certain. Like Windows 8 tablets, I think are pretty much going to take off in a way that Android tablets never have.
Mm-hmm. And the market is depending on that in a big way. When we look at what the market is doing, the market kind of gave up on Android tablets. They were wholly unsuccessful. The only guys who are kind of still standing in this space are I think the triple E PCs, the Transformers. People like those because they have keyboards and they kind of feel like
nobody's buying them is the thing. Like people are buying Samsung, but barely. And they're buying Kindle Fires, but those are barely Android tablets.
And those are, again, the starter tablets that just lead people to think, okay, I want an iPad. So
this is
make or break for the non-iPad tablet, I really feel like, unless somehow BlackBerry gets some infusion of $500 billion and does something else, which we know is not going to happen. So this is really the last stand. This is the last stand for non-iPad tablets. And I, on some level, I see why it hasn't been working, but I also see why this could work because it does give people that kind of like fallback of the Windows Explorer experience, and it does give people the ability to if it works, we have a situation where we have a dichotomy, not unlike iOS and Android or OS X and Windows that allows us to get some real like competition that forces growth. So that's cool.
I mean, there are a couple of reasons why Microsoft is really primed to sort of take over at least the second place spot in terms of tablets. Because if you think about it, like there is really no number two right now in tablets. There's the iPad and then there's Android just because they're actually making tablets, Android tablets, but nobody's really buying them.
Right.
It seems like when Android first went into tablets, they just threw the mobile OS there. They didn't have the apps to support it. They didn't have like the vision of using Android as a tablet OS. And that's been a problem. It's been a problem up until now. Like Ice Cream Sandwich, let me finally fix that. But nobody wants to develop for Android, at least on the tablet end. And that's a big problem. Whereas Microsoft is really getting these developers and basically treating the tablet like a PC.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, that's when the iPad really started taking off too, is when Apple had more productivity apps and had more accessories that let you do more with the iPad.
The iPad, hit, according to the keynote today, the iPad hit 200,000 native apps for the iPad. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the number is with Android, but I do remember Sean Ludwig
saying...
It is
in the hundreds.
Right.
I'm pretty sure because there's nothing there. I've tested many Android tablets. The ecosystem is terrible.
Do you guys remember when Sean Ludwig on this show, in response to a question that Andy asked, said that Microsoft was in the Windows 8 SDK was basically it was unclear whether they were giving the developers a lot of options for being able to make a tablet-based or Windows Phone 7-based version or subversion of the app in a very easy way, in addition to making the apps that they are making for this native operating system, for this desktop operating system. I remember Sean saying that, and I remember thinking, that is a wonderful idea. That's the next level. That's the way that this thing is going to sell if they do that. Yeah. So I wish you were.
Didn't we talk about that? About how one developer used like 90% of his code in the Windows Phone game to make a Windows 8 app? That's sort of thing. That cross development capability will be nice too, because right now it's tough to develop for Android. Like you're betting
on.
And
we know it's the apps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we know it's the apps. We know that the apps are what fuels people's needs.
Absolutely.
Wants and
absolutely.
For a platform. Yeah.
It's an app ecostructure for sure moving forward. And I think, Microsoft has keyed into that, and this is going to be their entry point into competing with Apple in a serious way.
What's funny is that they were working on this whole paradigm before the iPad came out. And unfortunately, like Microsoft being Microsoft, they were late to their own party. And now Apple has stole the game.
Hopefully not late to their own funeral. is the issue. The one thing that really threw me out was this is and this is like kind of going back in the day, but I remember there was a time, and there I guess it still kind of lingers, that the gaming world, the online, you know, computer games, they pushed the technology forward. The paradigms that they used, whether it was the hardware or the way that the games worked or whatever, they were pushing everything forward. And now look at this whole app ecosystem and everything, and I kind of feel like the idea that you are going to one place to get your games to get your apps, and that the apps are kind of like one platform was ported to, it was easily ported to another platform. Reminds me of that. Reminds me of like when GTA 3 would come out on the PS2 in like 2001 or 2002. And then a couple years later, 90% of that code was used to push it onto, you know, like Windows machines or, right, you know, things like that. It just kind of reminds me of the idea that there was kind of the gaming world was this closed ecosystem before. And you used to go to like GameSpot or whatever.com and you just click on your device. And from your device, all the software was listed there. I mean, it was not an app store. It wasn't some easy integrated downloadable whatever. But in some ways, it was an app store in that, like, your entire platform is represented on this tab of this website, and you can just order. You can organize by price, by size, by you know, whatever. And that kind of – it's not the same. I get it. But at the same time, that paradigm kind of – that's a word I'm using a lot tonight. That kind of – That outlook, the way that they kind of organized and made it so that, like, by platform, this is what you can get to make your device cooler, better, whatever. I like the fact that, like, Apple jumped on that a couple years ago, 2008 or 2009, and that the world is getting hip to that. And I think it's kind of interesting that, again, that comes from this kind of siloed gamer system perspective.
To take it back to the Windows 8 consumer preview, I will say that from my personal experience on the MacBook Air, I was a little disappointed that I wasn't able to get the MacBook Air touch pad to work like a multi-touch in the way that it can move the Metro apps around. It didn't quite function the way it would on a tablet, unfortunately. But I was very pleased that I was able to get Steam running and Skyrim working on my MacBook Air, which is you know, quite an experience to have Skyrim playing on a Mac.
How was that? Did you have an external mouse? Or did you use the trackpad to manipulate?
Yeah, you can use the trackpad to move the
character,
to move the camera, and then WASD for directions.
Wow, that sounds kind of exciting.
I mean, it's a little. You had to kind of take it down a couple of graphic notches because it's Skyrim and it's the MacBook Air. But other than that, it worked fine. And because it was on Steam, it carried over my game from my Windows on the Mac, the Windows iteration on my Mac Pro. So that was the one like thing I was really looking forward to, is playing Skyrim on the MacBook Air, and that worked out fine.
That's really exciting. I mean, that crossed by. I have a feeling that when Apple officially releases Bootcamp that's meant to be compatible with Windows 8, they may indeed figure out some ways to get that. I mean, Apple's never been a fan of trying to do touchscreen stuff on your other stuff, but I think that they'll probably make the drivers – they'll work with Microsoft to make the drivers the best, because Apple gets a lot of they get profit out of people buying their hardware. Microsoft gets profit out of people buying their software. So they're going to work together to make the best experience for the consumer.
You know what I'd love to see? We talked about this briefly, like I think a couple of weeks ago, is OnLive, the OnLive app for the iPad. I'd love to see Windows 8 on through the OnLive app on the iPad. I think that would be the ideal experience for Windows 8 on an iPad.
Right, so with the OnLive app, I found like the OnLive viewing app, and I found the OnLive desktop app, but I haven't found an OnLive app that allows me to get to OnLive game content on any iOS device. Have you guys seen anything like that? I haven't.
It's not game content. It is. I think it's the desktop environment. So
yeah, the desktop is the one Andy is talking about.
Oh, I see.
And they still haven't released one to let you actually play games on the iPad.
Right,
but
right. Okay.
They're working on it. Like, okay. There's a controller accessory too that's going to work with it at some point.
Any other last notes about Windows 8 consumer preview before we wrap up the show?
I'd recommend people check it out. It's a lot of fun to play with. I'm going to be getting one of the actual genuine Windows 8 test tablets soon.
Oh, nice.
Fun to play with.
All right, let's wrap up this show. Let me start with you, Devinder. Where can we find you on the internets when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about tech at VentureBeat.com, and I podcast about movies at /film.com. Everything else I do is at Devendra.org.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online?
Find me at Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me at Google Plus, qplus.to/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can also find me and what I'm up to, what I've been doing on flavors.me/DwayneD, DWAYNED.
As for me, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan. That's my Google Plus account with all my social links there. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Just go to their right-hand sidebar for all the podcasts. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com also. Once again, right-hand sidebar. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Please sign up at j.mp/subus if you want to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send your story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on TheDrillDown.com. And you can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.